Yeah, and in a way, it's an interesting thing. Shakespeare's plays have a kind of standard size of cast, and this is, if you pick this up in Felicity, this is an uncut version of Twelfth Night. But what's been added is, in effect, a chorus, which was not a standard part of Elizabethan theater. So it's almost like, in that way, it's almost a feature of something like Greek theater added onto it, that the chorus, the musicians are also a chorus and are relating, and they're not just accompanying, their presence and a kind of a collective player in it. Yeah. Yeah, I was actually thinking a lot about the yellow all the yellow costumes, or like this kind of yellow green that Andrew was wearing. And I felt like, I don't know if this was a thing you talked about out loud with the costume designer or not, but it was like that. I felt like there was something about foolishness and love that's about that yellow or yellow green color, that kind of, it's like a weird, it's an interesting, I felt like it was a motif somehow in the colors and the costumes that, yeah, if you cut that one line, it's no longer, it isn't an uncut version of Twelfth Night, but we lie. Yeah, I was aware of that because kind of how designers can kind of create another kind of level of underscoring or emphasis by just how they pick the colors, or make a statement somehow. So I was reading it that way. I don't know if it was intentional. But, yeah.
Our costume designer is actually Serbian, and the sort of aesthetic is inspired by this guy, Emir Kusturica, who's a Serbian director. He had this film Underground in the 90s, and the production is kind of an homage to his production and some. His film, in some ways, and it's yeah, I really think she's brilliant. Her name's Olivera Gacic, and I guess the things in the design that I thought really transformed things are her design for Festi. I thought really just created a whole other world. I was saying he's a hobo philosopher. He's a cross between Tom Waits and Dr. House, and he's the smartest person in the room, but he's also kind of falling apart. And actually, she didn't know what the word hobo was, and then I said like Snoopy when he runs away and he has the thing, and she was like, "So it's like Snoopy?" So no, it wasn't like Snoopy. And but yeah, and the word motley, which means this patched. The jester, which to me I was like anything but that, anything but the sort of classic shout at you. This is a clown. This is a clown. And yeah, she really did something kind of remarkable with that wig, like a bald cap that very clearly is fake, but has this crazy hair, and because it sort of goes with James Placer Toby, his natural hair, a little bit. So you sort of see that there. They're the kind of two avatars of the world of misrule.
So for those of you who've seen Pig Iron before, there's a lot of things that I've seen almost everything. I think I've missed one work in progress is the only thing I missed. And I missed the Odyssey, the very first thing, because it wasn't done before they went to Edinburgh. So I saw it in an incomplete version. It was completed at the opening in Edinburgh, as I remember. But so for those who've seen Pig Iron before, is there anything about the show that's surprising?
For this production, the actors look out to the audience so much, and there's so much contact with the audience, and that's been a big part of Pig Iron's research for a long time, is about this idea of contact with the audience, and how do you do it, and how much do you play for laughs, and how do you break the rhythm, but still include the audience in that rhythm. And with a new production, it just takes time to figure it out. So I think probably when we were playing with it back then in 2011, it was pretty new. Now I think we're coming off the tail end of we did three, we rehearsed it for 4 weeks in November, performed for 3 weeks in Philadelphia in December, just came from 3 weeks in New York. So I think there's a real fluency with the timing now, where that people can really play with the audience, say, "Okay, audience isn't going to make as much sound, but I can do something else with the pace." And it's something we talk about all the time, is, "Oh, hey, we never knew that would happen. How do we how do we leave room for that laugh, or how do we tell people, oh, we're actually moving on?
And it's something like 70 or 80 performances since you saw it last. And there's a thing of when a show has this long of a run, it's reaching a point where you've probably spent as much time performing it as you ever spent rehearsing it, or it's almost 50-50. So when you reach that tipping point, when a cast, and some of the actors have been with it the whole time, and some have only been with it for, say, two-thirds or three-quarters of that time. But so for those who've been with it all the way through, when you reach that tipping point of that, there's this, a certain kind of work on the production that happens with audiences over that run, and then there's a point where if it's an engaged cast, you know, it's actually an important phase of the work to do a long run like that.
So this gentleman is using the word devised, which is kind of a word that's getting used in America more and more, but it was kind of a British term, and it means that the company starts without a script and creates the script through a process of improvisation and playing on the stage. And I think it's a good distinction between something that is improvisational in the sense of we really don't know what we're going to do when we come out on stage and then we improvise it, versus something devised, which is made with the ensemble, and something scripted. So Pig Iron was started always to do devising, always. And after 15 years of doing that, we also had a secret motto to do the next hardest thing. So the next hardest thing was to stick to a script and see if we could do the things we cared about while still, if there was a way to do that, if there was a way to put those values of devising that the play is really about the energies between people, and if everybody could contribute to what was being created. So when we were working on the play originally, that idea for the wedding, we all watched this movie Underground and talked about it, but the idea for the wedding came from an actor in the ensemble, Blake, who originally played Sebastian. And so what if we just do that? So some of the greatest stuff in the play was generated by the ensemble, for sure. We did tons of research, and I still don't think we've cracked it, trying to figure out the torture of Malvolio and tried a whole bunch of different things with duct tape. And in a way, the duct tape comes from Festi's costume design, which we had, and then how do we take that language into... so that there is this language of devising that led to what people call interpretation of the script. I feel like I wouldn't do it any other way. I feel like you kind of need to devise for 10 years before you can do a script in a lot of ways, because there's so many other... I'm kind of a zealot when it comes to my approach to scripts and the way a script works. I was very bookish as a kid, and I went to Swarthmore, the giant bookishness of books here. For me, a script is a platform from which to build a play. And I think there's been, especially in America for some reason, this kind of idea of we have to have a fidelity to the script or a faithfulness to the script. And I'm like, well, I just don't know that that's the right posture to have towards a script. And having made devised work for more than a decade, you know that you can go out and make something. You know that you can go out and own the stage and make things happen, decide when to talk, decide when not to talk. And I feel like that is a crucial, that's crucial. And I actually think that's how Shakespeare's company worked. I think that the companies in that time were groups of actors and shareholders who were actors and writers, sometimes with several writers in the company. Hey, we'll do your play. Hey, we'll do this person's play, which is a hit, but we'll put in a little piece of my play here because everyone loves that. You know, when you see representations in Shakespeare plays of how theater's being done, like in Hamlet, Hamlet's like, I'll write a little part, and you do this part. Do that greatest hit that you do, and then I'll write a little part for you, which is devising, basically. it's sort of implied that the players know Hamlet from him hanging out, sometimes performing, sometimes writing. So I guess I guess another thing I think about in terms of the devising to script move is where does the impulse to speak come from? I think sometimes when actors who work with scripts and scripts and scripts, they never have to think of that, never have to think about, at this moment I could speak or I could do something else. So in a way there's a step missing, and I feel that I can feel a kind of hollowness in the life of the play. That was sort of the plan. I mean, I think actually the way that we got into the play is we got a grant to do Midsummer Night's Dream. We tried to work on it, and I couldn't figure it out. And I couldn't figure out the fairies, and I couldn't figure out why Titania's speech was so long. I also just felt that we had been sort of, people had bullied us to try to do Midsummer Night's Dream. I said, all right, let's give in and do it. And then we were too old. Insensibility. I sort of said, oh, you know, in Midsummer Night's Dream, there's no secrets. There's one secret, which is, I'm running off to the forest. Don't tell anybody. Next scene, it's like, they're running off to the forest. And then that's the only secret. And then Twelfth Night has all this yearning and this Chekhovian quality where everybody's got this secret love. And that yearning just felt more appropriate to the kind of bittersweetness that we were feeling at that moment.
It got louder, but the mic's over here. Anyway, sorry.
So we kind of started the process with a devising idea, which was, okay, so what would this play be if it was a pig iron play? If we just took this as source material of inspiration, and that sort of was the idea of, there's this guy, he's got this band that plays the saddest music in the world, and he's like, play it, play it, play it, play it, which is sort of the beginning of the play. And then there's this other guy who says, I want to have a huge party where we drink and like play the most raucous music in the world, and that's Toby. And it was going to be these dueling bands, basically. And Malvolio is a guy going, shusha, no music, no music, and the bands run him over. And we said, okay, that's a piece we could make, and the music for that might be this great Balkan music, which has both of those qualities as being the saddest, sobbingest music in the world. Or it also can have this, we just got to dance and drink and shout. And that's when we invited Rosie Langebier, who makes a lot of different kinds of music, but loved that movie, Underground, and loved the composer of Kusturica's movies. And her band in New Zealand had a mixture of jazz and Balkan music. And so that Balkan music became, well, how can we translate this into the world of the play? That's interesting. The gentleman who plays him is sitting in the back hiding. His name is Chris Thorne. And he does a really wonderful job with it. I mean, I've heard both that it's also the saddest Malvolio ever. I've heard that too. But I kind of think actually the word that you're using that I'm interested in is uncomfortable. And that was kind of playing against the grain for me, because I like to make plays that make people uncomfortable. But I kind of felt like, you know what? I don't think that's the purpose of this. I think it should feel sad and delightful, but somehow so right. It shouldn't feel like an outlier. And I think it had to do with the trying to have a musical approach to the play, in the sense of it should feel like it's part of the music and it has to go that way. And yeah. I know what you mean. It's a funny aspect of the play, that he sort of has grown so much in the audience's imagination. I guess, I don't know, did other people feel not sad for Alvin Mavalier, or you did feel sad?
I felt so sad for Antonio that I had no sympathy left for Mavalier.
Zero sum gain.
The torturing scene.
Yeah, I was anticipating it, and it felt like it fit in much better.
Yeah. I think, you know, that's kind of a value of, like, I really realized that after the 2011 production and kind of brought that to Chris and Richie, who kind of taught me about the scene. They were like, we got to go, it's got to go fast. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's the whirly gig that we're trying to make happen here so that it just slips away from you. I think this focus on making people uncomfortable, I was proud of it, but I thought, oh, you know what? I don't need to get any points right here. It's really funny. Actually, my history with Shakespeare goes back to being a senior here at college and Alan Kuharsky being my advisor and the word uncomfortable. And in a way, maybe I'm throwing off your yoke with this play. Because I had
You never did any of the assignments I gave you anyway.
I was a real brat, that's for sure.
He was a great student. He never did the assignment ever.
I'm a real jerk.
Not in the directing class, in the academic classes.
Well, I've secretly been doing your assignment for 20 years, though, because you... And here's one I did do, which is it was my final project, and I had seen a production of Pericles, Shakespeare's Pericles, this weird, obscure play, and I was like, I'm going to do Pericles, and there's going to be music by the Talking Heads, not live, but... and there's going to be video of fish, and it's going to be great. And Alan said, you know what? If you do Shakespeare, you're going to be a hero, and everyone's going to love you. Why don't you do something difficult? Why don't you do something everybody's going to hate? And I said, oh, okay. Okay. And I didn't do Shakespeare. Yeah, you did. And I did David Mamet's American Buffalo, which is a super misogynist male play. I don't know that everyone hated it. I don't know that I did a good job with it either. It was all right. But I think that was sort of the beginning. Well, that was, I guess, you're not the only mentor I had who said, do things that make people uncomfortable. That's something worth exploring.
But you know, the thing I thought about a lot watching it tonight, and I've seen the show now 3 or 4 times, so this is probably my 4th viewing today, is you did this? You did the Cyrano with string quartet.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was probably, in a way, this was in retrospect, and you guys don't mention it so much anymore. But you used to talk about it as kind of the first time that the idea of something like Pig Iron occurred to you guys, and included Dito and other people who were part of the original Pig Iron ensemble. And it was Cyrano de Bergerac with a live string quartet done in Bond, if you know our campus, and it was a Drama Board production. And it was a kind of, for you guys, I think it was a really formative exercise, and it was done completely on your own, and it was a big kind of event on campus at the time. And that the idea of, the, you know, here, 20 years later, with the band, you know, following the classic play around, you know, that's what I was really flashing on a lot, and it took me seeing it several times to see that. But,
Yeah, we did. It was called Cyrano for 2 quartets, and it was 4 actors and 4 musicians. Mm-hmm. And the audience moved around, and the idea was to try to translate Cyrano into both dance and theater and music. And yeah, actually, that's the first time it's very. Somebody said the band is a character, and that's very much what we wanted with that band too, and that. That band is the gods, and that band knows how the play is going to go and sort of stands in for the power of music and the power of love to move people. Because I think that's sort of how I feel about music. Like, when I hear music, I feel like I know what goes with it. I feel like it makes me do things. And so that happens a lot in some Pig Iron plays.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's a great image too. Actually, somehow I didn't appreciate it as much in the earlier times I saw it, and this weekend I'm really getting the carpet, because it's one of these things that we talk about a lot in directing workshops, of like how props have a journey, and they're like puppets. They kind of take on meaning, and like if they keep coming back, and so the carpet, if you think about how they're unrolled, and it's how kind of. It's almost like a light cue that when a carpet is unrolled, it's kind of something's going to happen and a certain kind of thing is going to happen. But it's also, it's low status, right? I mean, it's on the ground. It's right, it's base.
No, but it's an oriented
part. But it's both. No, but that's what I'm saying. It's really both. It's the beautiful thing, but it's also the thing that is where people put their feet, or, you know, it's where your feet hit the ground. So it's like to turn that into your thing of dignity is kind of the whole problem that the character is in, is that low or high or low and high. And it's a bit. Yeah. Well, it creates a world. It's like every time they use it, it creates a world, right? Yeah.
So Chris is new playing Malvolio. He didn't play Malvolio in the first run. So you weren't part of when we first made that. For me, it's the law of the room. I do very little preparation at home. And it's taken a long time to trust that, or it took 5 or 6 years to trust that. And I guess it's sort of two things. It's kind of having a scientific approach of it has to live on stage. It has to live on stage. And I see my job in creating a devising laboratory as like just get the life moving on stage and then everything will be right. The right things will emerge without too much forcing. And I guess also I'm always practicing being the audience and seeing it for the first time. So that's also why I try not to prepare. It's cocky and scary sometimes, especially the first couple days is really always a horrible nightmare for me that nothing will happen this time. One of the sort of seminal books on directing and theater is Peter Brook's The Empty Space. And I think it's in this book that he says, if you're going on an archaeological dig, you can't say, I will find a horse, you know, a statue of a horse, and then dig, and you're like, aha, here's my horse. I guess I flash on that sometimes when it's like, you've really got to be open to what happens in the room. I think it's a dialogue between me and the performers. You know, we used to do things with no words and just props for a long time. So like, I think that kind of gets soaked into the way of working that, well, I'm going to do something with this prop now, and that's what will happen. And then sometimes I think it shouts out to me too, like, well, that prop has to go over there now. But I tend not to. Even something as simple as the musicians said, in New York, the theater was shaped differently, and the musicians would walk down the aisle that the audience came in as they got set up. And they said, well, can't we just come from here? And I just said, I don't know. I have to see it. Go do it. And they walked, and I said, oh, of course. Yeah, you can do that. But in a way, I don't allow myself to say that will work until I see it. These are prescient and painful questions. When we're devising from scratch, I mean, there's times when, you know, we made a piece about James Joyce's schizophrenic daughter, and everybody played her as we were working on it. But in the performance, one person played her. And I think that was the most painful hinge. We call that the hinge moment. Like, now is the time to stop messing around. At that hinge, there's also a moment. The job of actor at Pig Iron is different from the job of actor in most of the world, where I really am asking everybody to think about the whole play, because everybody is going to play Lucia Joyce, or everybody is going to play some other characters. So, but we found over time, for us, for this group, for our culture, that there was a moment where, and there's just nobody to decide but me, when I'm the director, to say, now is the hinge, and concentrate on what you are doing. At the same time, I try to never let it be frozen. So exactly what you're talking about, all those accidents, we keep talking about them even as recently as yesterday, even having worked on it. So I'm at 90% of the performances, 80%. And I guess, you know, the theater companies I admire have always had that kind of attention from the director. There's sort of a funny thing in America where they talk about a show being frozen. Let's freeze the show. That it can't be changed anymore. And it's kind of a commercial idea about the show, that it's a you can't ask more of the actors and the stage manager if you're always fussing with it. The product's done, and it's inefficient. And I guess, you know, this is our last performance after a long time, and I sort of was saying to the whole cast and of my collaborators today how grateful I was that nobody had succumbed to the desire for efficiency, and that everybody had such a, that's a lot of people, 17 people. And people come to theater for a lot of different reasons, and you still have to make a living, and you still have to be remain sane. So, I think the goal of adding in that time for us to communicate is to talk about, first of all, how are things going differently with this audience in this space, in this the particulars here, you know, that it's not set and it just goes exactly like that, and exactly for those happy accidents. I guess I'm trying to remember the most recent happy accident I don't remember what the most recent one is. Eva, do you remember one at all? Something that got added recently or that we found and that we kept with?
You know, in a way, just to go back to the question that way back about the carpet and the exit and how we set up your last exit, that what I was saying to Dan after the show today, because I've seen the show four or five times now, and what was actually clear to me for the first time today was something I was going, duh. I mean, because I've heard Pig Iron talk about this, and it's something I emphasize always in my own teaching and the directing workshops here, is that but it's this thing of like we're in a process of collaboration, and the way you guys make your work devised or off a script is that this whole set is a brilliant illustration of a machine for entrances and exits. And that not in mostly non-literal. Yeah. So there's like the upstage center entrance is like the Greek theater. It's like boom, it's in the Oresti, it's written in. And so they have that. But then like the slide is something totally non-literal and hugely important, and then underneath the slide, and then into the audience, and then the steps on the side, and then the second thing behind the steps on the side, right? And that how many ways can actors be in and out of the space? And there's almost nothing not there's almost no area unactivated in it. And then Pig Iron has for years been doing these workshops called Entrances and Exits, and that it's in a way a collective improvisation question that. We're going through this with a directing student, frankly, right now, of one of the director's prerogatives in a more conventional way of doing a show is all the transitions are the director's job to figure out. Like, what's the rhythm? What's the meaning, if any? How does it feed the show? How does it not mess up the show that you have, whatever the transitions are? And so, like, I felt like, and it's, I was a set designer first, and that's how I approached set design, was to break everything down into entrances and exits first and figure out a scheme, and ideally, for me, a metaphorical scheme that's in those entrances and exits. And in this process, looking at a show at such a late, like, sophisticated, finished, complete form like this one, that, like, the set, where is the set designer? Where was it the set designer? Where was it you? Where was it improv? Where was it a metaphor? Where is it Shakespeare? You know, like where, how do you arrive at this kind of amazing machine for delivering and exiting actors and characters, right? And so, and the musicians too, right? It's in the upper balcony and all those. It's such a rich thing, and it's mostly not literal, right? It's mostly
something that's else. That's so baked in now that I don't even notice anymore. And I guess I would love to hear from folks who are seeing this about. You jogged my memory about an argument with an actor 3 years ago about, but that way is her house. And I said, no, I don't think so. I don't think that way is her house. I think the space is recycled all the time. And someone says, I'm going here. And they go off and they're going there. I'm not distracted by a weight I thought that was there. And I think other people were also saying, well, can the attendants really be the same people at Olivia's house and at Orsino's house? And I sort of said, yeah, I think they're halfway between the band and the actors. And it's not a problem that they are the same attendants at either place. It sort of that's how the rich people feel about them. They are interchangeable, you know. and even in the play, it's like, well, I'm sometimes the fool is sometimes employed there, and sometimes they are doormen with two jobs in this tiny in this. Yeah, absolutely, and never do Orsino. They cannot enter from there.
But I would say that feels like maybe the only spot that has a name.
Yeah. It's downstairs.
Yeah.
But then one of the most hilarious exits, really, for me, that from the very first time I saw it, is when the tuba goes in there. Right? I mean, you know, because it's just like the it's perfectly crafted. It can happen, but it shouldn't happen, but it has to happen. It's like so many, like, levels to the joke of it.
That was some preparation. I mean, the set designer, who's a damn genius herself, Maiko Matsushima, she went through probably 5 totally different designs, different models. I definitely said, the play has to be both inside and outside. Have I really never dealt with this problem in all of my devising before? And we talked about that a lot. And then we got Josh with his sousaphone, and we walked in and out of the door to my back patio and measured it and, like, put a piece of wood against the door to say, like, all right, let's not mess this up. We got to learn how he can get through with the sousaphone. So, in a way, I prepare a little bit more that way, like spatially, than dramaturgically, probably. Yeah. But I remember, and that we actually posted that on Facebook, I think. Like, here we are figuring out the door distance with Josh and the sousaphone. Yeah.
And the other exit that's only ever done once, and it's actually not even fully done, is the little triangle door that Andrew Aguecheek. Is that really new? Because I was going, okay, so did she know to have that hinged from the beginning, or?
Yeah.
And was it always available, and when was it activated?
It was there. I couldn't deal with it because Andy's a great collaborator with Pig Iron, who has that vibe of how can I use all the stuff. He was like, we got to use it. Yeah. And he did it behind my back, and I said, don't do that. And he did it. And they. and then he worked out a bit with him and Chad, who plays the drums. And Chad, I really liked the sound of Chad. I just could hitting the door closed with his mallet. I said, "Oh, those sweet musician guys. It's getting real." And I dug that a lot. And they worked it out on their own. That was more of my brilliant directing done by other people, and forced down my throat in a great way. So a year before the 2011 premiere, we were workshopping Midsummer Night's Dream. Then we abandoned that and went begging to the NEA and Philadelphia Theater Initiative. Remember how you approved that grant for Midsummer Night's Dream? Is 12th Night so different, really? 6 months later, we did our first workshop on that with no set. And we did a workshop really focusing on music, where we had Rosie in the band. And we did a lot of improvisations about drunkenness and playing around with the text and I don't remember what else. I remember the improvs about drunkenness and music. And status. In that first one? This is the one on Brandywine Street?
Yeah.
Got you.
Yeah.
And that must have come to me right then, because I don't know why I thought that. Because I was surprised at how important that was to the play, was status.
Well, for Mariah, status is like ginormous.
And then Maiko was making all those set designs, and once we fixed on the ramp, we knew we had to rehearse from day one on that ramp. So the ramp was the only thing. We squeezed it into Pig Iron's, at that time, brand new studio, where we could fit the ramp. It had to be built inside the room, and you couldn't stand up at the top. So any scenes we were setting at the top while we were rehearsing there had to be, like, hunched down. And then just now, when we redid it, because we had done it for a while, we rehearsed for 2 weeks with no set, but then we moved everybody out to this large stage at Temple University, which we rented for a week, just to put up the ramp so that all the new actors could work with the ramp for a week. Then we took it all down, moved it to the Fringe space where we performed it for 3 weeks in December. And then, yeah, so we always knew we had to do that. And sometimes when we are looking at a set design, we will say, how can we mock this up to do that kind of law of the room and test it out? I remember for this show, Chekhov Lizard Brain, also at Temple, we were like, can we have an entrance? Can the only entrance be this high on the wall? Wow, that's an amazing idea. No, it cannot be that high. That is incredibly, you have to be a really trained acrobat to go in and out of something at 4 feet. So we said that will not work, and we rejected that set design, thank God, before we built it. So yeah, that's the answer, is we try to work with as much set as we can, and yeah. I did not audition any actors with the ramp. Everybody slid down the ramp, even me, at some point or another. And I don't think we increased our insurance due to the ramp. I don't know what, I think when you're picking, flying somebody increases your insurance. But I don't think a ramp does. But I think also, again, these actors were pretty game, and they were ready to slide.
On that, what is the tryout process like for actors and actresses in Scrooge?
Well, I was just going to say, too, that so this is, in one way, well, not it's one category of work that Pig Iron does, which is that Pig Iron is a company, and that there are regular actors in Dido and James Sugg and many you saw today, and others that were in the first cast are long-term company members, so there aren't always auditions. And then when there's a big, they do shows like this that have a big expanded cast, then they open it up to other people, or people can't do a revival or a tour, so then that gets handed over as a finished thing. So, but there are Pig Iron shows where it's very much the company actors without an audition or a tryout, and then this is one where there were a lot of auditions and tryouts. So just for people who are kind of getting familiar with Pig Iron, there's really different types of projects.
There's different types of projects, so different types of auditions. You know, we're about to do some auditions for a show that we're making from scratch called I Promise Myself to Live Faster, and in those auditions are going to have an hour ensemble audition where we just sort of play with the material, the source material, for an hour. And then the callbacks will actually be 3 days long and will be paid. So because we're not looking for folks to fill roles, we're looking for folks to make roles. And vibe is really important. And so I'd say those auditions are a mix of, it's sort of just a little miniature version of how we make work. I sort of had to learn to audition differently for Twelfth Night, and in a way I felt very out of my depth. It was only the second script I had done since American Buffalo when I was a senior in college, and I really was unprepared for the demands that a script makes on people, you know, even in terms of, oh yeah, there's just so many different, it's just different. And I guess I'm getting a little better at it now. We tried to mix both for this project. So we had very traditional auditions at first where people would come in and do a monologue. I think they did like a Shakespeare monologue, and then we said, oh yeah, we want you for this part. But that then we would have a version of what I'm talking about, where we would get together for a few hours, and I think we did improvisations about listening to music and falling in love, and then being drunk. I think we did improvisations about being drunk, and read some scenes from the play. Once the production was done, then the then I had a much better sense when I was casting folks who were new this time around in terms of, oh, okay, I got a feeling about how this will work chemically.
And it's really kind of, I would say, like, a lot of the questions today about, like, how Dan worked, say, during a run of a performance as the director, or how script comes in and out of rehearsal, you know, even, I mean, for some of the actors that are with us today, they're not company members, they're equity actors, but that the kind of one of the mission statements of, or mission dimensions of the mission of Pig Iron is to not conform to conventional commercial, definitely commercial and other professional practices in American theater, and it's not to be less professional, but to be able to go to other ways of working. And so a lot of the kind of assumptions about how things are made not only don't apply to Pig Iron, it's very intentional to go against those practices. So what Dan was saying about one of the short versions of it, I would say, is that American theater is driven by efficiency. And once you kind of embrace efficiency, inefficiency in the service of another artistic quality, you hit all of the problems of the profit-driven theater in particular. But then there are other things. Like, my introduction to theater was in Shakespeare festivals, and it was forbidden for the director to give notes or change anything after the opening. And there was one director who was the best director who had permission to break the rule. And he impressed me. He was actually from Austria, and he was, like, actually the most famous director working in Cleveland in that festival that summer. And he somehow got permission to meet with the actors after every show, and they would sit with the reviews, and he would give notes, and they were doing all these things that were the other director, and it was like I was 20 or 21, and I was going, this is where I want to work or not. And the other director who directed, like, was the star director every season, opened the show, went to a dirty movie, and left town.
Right on.
That was his way of, like, and everyone said, oh, yeah, that's what he does. That. That's how he puts the show away. And, you know, that was, you know, he was following kind of a standard practice as a pretty decent Shakespeare director, you know. So, in that. So there's a lot of things about, again, what actors are asked to do in this environment that they wouldn't be in another environment, what an audition is, what text is. We don't have time to talk about copyright issues that Pig Iron is sometimes, you know, hit up against because of things they want to be able to work with that aren't conventional plays, things like that.